Today in Studio 360, Mark Mothersbaugh started his career doing the odd and sometimes irritating music of Diva.
Now whip it good.
But now he's one of Hollywood's most in-demand film composers, working with directors like Wes Anderson. I'll also talk with Mark Mothersbaugh about his secret life as a visual artist.
If it's 3 a.m. and I didn't do any drawings all day, I have to wake up and do it.
We'll also hear about the opera, yep, the opera that is causing intense controversy. John Adams' The Death of Klinghoffer is based on a real story of Palestinian hijackers who murder an innocent man. Some people think it's too sympathetic to the killers.
I think that's a red herring. I don't think it's anti-Semitic.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Delta Airlines, whose new Delta Studio provides all kinds of streaming entertainment in the sky. Movies, shows, even live TV, all on your personal devices. Learn more at delta.com. Delta, keep climbing. And by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. If you go to haunted houses this time of year, willingly or unwillingly, they might have gotten a whole lot scarier. There's somebody writing music for haunted attractions who is trying to go way beyond dopey, creepy sound effects. But first, political protests outside a government building, sure, or a corporation's headquarters, okay, but a big protest outside an opera house about an opera? Earlier this week, a few hundred demonstrators took to the street in front of the Metropolitan Opera in New York City to protest The Death of Klinghoffer by the composer John Adams. The opera is based on the real-life hijacking of the cruise ship Achille Lauro by Palestinian commandos in the Mediterranean in 1985. The Klinghoffer of the title is Leon Klinghoffer, an actual Jewish-American tourist who was murdered by the hijackers. When The Death of Klinghoffer debuted 23 years ago, a few critics claimed it was too sympathetic to the Palestinian cause and the hijackers, and too unsympathetic to the Jewish characters and Israel. Now, 23 years later, a lot more people are even more outraged about a production, the first, by the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. And New York Magazine critic Justin Davidson was there, and he is here with me now. Justin, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, recap for us. What is the controversy about?
The controversy is that some people have felt that the opera is anti-Semitic. It was just felt that the opera humanizes the terrorists, maybe romanticizes them. That's the word that Leon Klinghoffer's daughters used in a letter that was printed in the Met program.
I've listened to the opera. I have read the libretto. You've just seen it. Bottom line, anti-Semitic, do you think?
I think that's a red herring. I don't think it's anti-Semitic. I think it's got all kinds of problems, some of them political, some of them moral, some of them structural. And I think that there's a real problem, fundamental, and I think this is why they've laid themselves open to the accusations of anti-Semitism, with saying, okay, these whack jobs with guns got on this boat, hijacked it, and wound up shooting a passenger and dumping him and his wheelchair overboard, a barbaric act. Let's try to understand
where
these people came from.
Yeah.
Now, let me be clear. I don't think the project of trying to understand why people do terrible things is inherently either humanizing or justifying. But boy, it's tricky.
The first line of the opera is this Palestinian chorus, and it's, "My father's house was razed in 1948 when the Israelis passed over our street."
It's a hugely inflammatory line anyway, and to begin the opera with that is really provocative. Because it's an incredibly complicated history. To toss that off and say, well, the Israelis came and razed my father's house, you're really asking for trouble.
And musically, this piece of music is good. You think it's an important John Adams score. What did he do to sort of, here's the musical expression of the Palestinians, here's the musical expression of the Jews?
The terrorists kind of dominate the whole first half, and you get each one of them in turn. There are four of them, and each one kind of laying out their case and taking control of the ship. And so you don't actually hear from Klinghoffer himself or his wife, Marilyn, who in a way you could say are the moral center of the opera, until after intermission.
Although when you do hear from Klinghoffer, he is the sane, human, likable guy whom you have then rooting interest for. And his wife, after he's dead, gets the last word in this moving way.
That's true. I mean, I think that to me, the linchpin of the opera comes in before Klinghoffer is murdered, and he has this dialogue with the craziest of the terrorists, who is this guy Rambo.
I've never been a violent man, ask anyone. I'm a person who just as soon avoid trouble. But somebody's got to tell you the truth.
And Klinghoffer says, look, none of this means anything. You guys just like killing people, and we are the kind of people you like to kill. And he has a very humane aria, which is followed by this scene of Rambo, the terrorist, spouting a lot of the really hardcore anti-Semitic lines that have been quoted out of context. And it's a crazy contrast. I mean, there's all of this electronic music that kind of muddies what he's saying, and the rhythms get very herky-jerky, and clearly this is a psychotic guy.
Always complaining of your suffering, but wherever poor men are gathered, you can find Jews getting fat.
There is musically a very clear contrast between Klinghoffer's passion and sanity and humane quality and the terrorists' hopped-up ideological and murderous intensity. Adams does well is to distinguish characters and groups and points of view musically. The problem, I think, is that Adams was dealing with a libretto that didn't do that nearly as well. So he was really working with a handicap. Why he thought that libretto was as strong as he does and why he didn't demand really fundamental changes to it, I think I don't understand, and I think is a real fundamental, unhealable problem of the opera.
And I didn't know until I was researching this that the librettist, Alice Goodman, was born and raised Jewish in America, and that while she was writing this opera, she converted to Christianity and became an Anglican priest.
Well, certainly some people saw in her rejection of her Jewish and Zionist upbringing, a kind of self-hatred that expressed itself in the opera. I don't know her. I would hesitate to speculate about the psychology of that.
On balance, do you think the Metropolitan Opera should have staged it in 2014?
Sure. Because, I mean, you know, we've been spending a lot of time talking about its flaws. But at the core of the opera is a really strong score that is not perfect either, but it just has some incredible moments. And there are chains of things that happen. And some of the action is incredibly gripping. The way certain characters kind of turn in on themselves and are allowed to express themselves. You know, one of the ironies of that is that there's this really wonderful moment after Klinghoffer has been murdered and his body is floating in the Mediterranean, and it, or he, sort of after death, sings this very contemplative aria. You know, the words for that aria don't mean very much to me, but the music does. And I'm not advocating just sort of neutralizing. Music has content. But I think that, you know, with all the difficulties and all the problems and all the mixed feelings that I have, you know, that's not unusual in opera. Opera is very rarely, I mean, I can't think of more than a handful of operas in the entire repertoire that I think are really perfect.
Justin Davidson, this has been fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Justin Davidson is a critic for New York Magazine. By the way, the music you heard during our conversation was not from the Met's new production, but from a 1992 recording of The Death of Klinghoffer. If you have seen or heard or read the opera, what do you think? Do you think the subject is just too volatile to make a good subject for art at this big deal level at this moment? Let us know at studio360.org. Coming up next, Juliette Binoche explains why, after winning an Academy Award, she hid from Hollywood.
Because there's a sense of guilt, you know, when you're successful in France. And so I think I was going through my guilt.
That is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Delta Airlines, whose long-haul fleet has flatbed seats available with direct aisle access. Learn more at delta.com. Delta, keep climbing. And by Lumosity.com, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Think of the British and European film dramas you've seen in the last few decades. Juliette Binoche was probably in a lot of them. The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Wuthering Heights, The English Patient, Cachet, Chocolat.
Well, if you're expecting me to just shrivel up and blow away, you're going to be highly disappointed.
She is the go-to actress for roles that are sensual but with complexity, gravitas. Her latest movie, Clouds of Sils Maria, just had its U.S. premiere at the New York Film Festival. It is a very sly meta movie where reality blurs a lot with fiction. Binoche plays a French star whose breakthrough role came years ago as a young, ambitious girl. And now, many years later, Maria is asked to appear in that same play, but this time as the older woman.
I played Sigrid when I was 18.
And because you were Sigrid, only you can be Helena now.
And the play tells a simple story. An older woman falls in love with a scheming girl that has her wrapped around her little finger. The girl takes advantage of her, squeezes everything she can out of her, then dumps her.
It's called The Real World. Welcome.
That's Kristen Stewart as the assistant. Chloe Grace Moretz plays the young actress. And Juliette Binoche is the star. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
I understand that you had the germ of an idea for this film, and you went to Olivier Assayas with it. Is that right?
Yes. I phoned him one day, and I said, you know what? I think you should write about the feminine. We need women on screen. And I thought of those three characters and having three points of view and them exchanging roles, actually. And I
sounds kind of abstract as an idea.
Yes, but at the same time, I felt like because I had worked with him before, you know, in Summer Hours, and he's such a wonderful writer, I thought, you know, Olivier is the person I'd like to do the film with.
Yeah, which is why you called him up and said, hey, I've got this idea. Write me a movie. Yeah.
Well, it's an invitation to writing. It's not like, write me this movie. You know, it doesn't happen like that. It has to be a little more subtle.
I understand. You seduced him. Figuratively speaking.
You know, seduction in English is not the same meaning as séduction in French.
I know. I'm using the French version.
Do you know what it is?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean sexual seduction.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Very good. You speak French?
No, but I can pretend. At one point in the movie, there's a very funny scene where you and your personal assistant, played by Kristen Stewart, watch a ridiculous Hollywood sci-fi movie with a heroine who has superpowers. And afterwards, you're both analyzing this film.
Well, I stayed because of you, but I could feel my brain cells dying one by one.
Okay, but you don't find her amazing? I think she's totally fascinating.
It's such a stupid character. Come on.
Because it takes place on a spaceship? I know that if it was set on an assembly line or like a farm or something, you'd love it.
That's true. I have a hard time taking bimbos in astronaut suits, mouthing off some generic pop psychology seriously. Been there, done that.
That was Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart in The Clouds of Sils Maria. Been there, done that. A lot has been made over the years of the fact that you turned down a role in Jurassic Park and turned down a role in Mission Impossible and turned down a role in some Indiana Jones sequel. So this year, shockingly, you show up in Godzilla.
Yes.
Did you change your mind about Hollywood?
Well, first of all, it started with a letter of Gareth Edwards, the director. And I was touched by his words and his demand. And I said, my son, you know, oh, guess what? And
you've got a 20-year-old son.
Yeah, and he loves Godzilla. So in a way, It was from him, but not only. It's because it was fun for me to be in something new.
Uh-huh.
And also, it was great prep for Seals Maria.
How so?
Well, because it was just before I shot Seals Maria. And I'm saying, been there, done that.
Oh, I see. You had been there. I see. The fiction and reality just don't stop blurring.
You know, things come to you in a mysterious way. And sometimes you say, yeah, that's it. That's what I needed to do.
In order to say that line believably, you had to be in Godzilla.
Exactly.
There's a kind of motif in a lot of your early films. You play young women who are very sensual and comfortable with nudity. In Damage, which was your 1992 movie with Jeremy Irons, there are graphic sex scenes, and you're also this silent, cryptic character. Was that difficult?
Well, acting is difficult. Actually, when you use as an object in a film, as a woman as an object in a film, that becomes a problem. But when you're a subject going through love or, you know, whatever, you know, you need to go through, then it's, for me, it's another story. It's like paintings without nudity wouldn't be, you know, the history of painting. It's part of, you know, what art is and what human being is. We don't, you know, we don't come to the earth fully clothed. We're naked. There's something about being bare that is very, makes you vulnerable and truthful.
Mm-hmm.
But how it's used can be tricky. And that's how, you know, as actors and actresses especially, you've got to be intelligent. You know, it happened even in Blue, Kieslowski, who's, you know, one of the greatest directors. And there was a scene where I was supposed to walk naked in a room. And I said, why do you need me naked? And he didn't really know what to answer. And I say, do you know how many questions I have about nakedness and how difficult it is? It's a weight for me and I don't need it. And after a while, he came back to me and said, we won't do it. When it's necessary for the storytelling, when I feel like, yeah, she's exposed, she's in love. Yes, I go for it because I think it's part of life.
Yeah. You won your Academy Award for The English Patient, in which you played a nurse at the end of World War II who is looking after this horribly burned man, played by Ralph Fiennes.
This is in your handwriting, is it?
Yes, it is.
December 22nd. Betrayals in war are childlike compared with our betrayals during peace. New lovers are nervous and tender, but smash everything. For the heart is an organ of fire. For the heart is an organ of fire. I love that. I believe that.
You have won a zillion awards, Best Actress at Cannes in Berlin and Venice and the Caesar in France. Was winning an Oscar just another award, or was that a special thing?
Of course it was a special thing, but I didn't believe I was going to get anything. And so when they called me, I was very surprised, and I was ready to give it to Lorraine Bacall. Everybody was expecting she was going to get it. And yet, she didn't, you know, she didn't stand up. She didn't come. So I thought, you know, in a few seconds, okay, I'll keep it then.
And so then the next day, you just went back to work? Or did the Oscar change your career?
Well, I was, during that period of time, I was offered quite a lot of things. And just, I think probably by a way of protecting myself, I went back to Europe and to
avoid going Hollywood.
No, to because there's a sense of guilt, you know, when you're successful in France, and so I think I was going through my guilt. Huh. I was hiding a little bit.
Huh. You have worked with a lot of great directors, like Kieslowski, like Godard, like Anthony Minghella. Given how obviously interested you are in this. Ineffable relationship between directors and actors and the process of filmmaking, I'm surprised you haven't made a film as a director.
I'm surprised too. Well, of course I've been thinking about it, but at the same time I have to say that I've been working with so many great directors that really allow me to be part of the direction. And I love staying on set. I think that's really has been a key for me, that instead of going away in the trailer.
Really?
Or going in a, you know, in a dressing room, wherever, you stay on set and you see what's going on and how the shot is going to be, you know, decided.
So you've had all the training. You've stuck around the set. You can do it tomorrow.
Yeah, but you have to choose the subject you want to say. You know, that's mainly what it is, because putting a camera, it's not that difficult. It's like, how do you want to tell the story? And You know, that's the real thing.
You have, I discovered, painted for most of your life. Really nice portraits, by the way. Some of your paintings appeared in a movie you did last year called Words and Pictures. Why do you paint?
Why not?
Well, because you've got lots of stuff to do, or
no,
not.
No, it's just that as I remember my mother, we didn't have a lot of money, but there was a moment she earned some money. She wrote some
books. She was an artist, right?
Yeah. She bought 100 books of paintings and sculpting. And so I got passionate about those books. And every weekend I would take one or two and I would copy, because I wanted to enter those paintings. I wanted to enter those sculptures. And
right.
So
but lots of people have that story. And then they go to university and they become adults and they stop doing it. You've kept
Well,
doing
I stopped for a while. But then, you know, being living with Lewis Carax, and he was writing a script and was a little bored. And so I would start, you know, drawing him and painting. And then he wrote that I was painting in the script, in the story. And that's how Lovers on the Bridge, I'm a painter, because he saw me drawing.
I'm telling you, your fiction reality thing is just, that's the motif of Juliette Binoche's life, I guess. Well, I'm eager to see your next films. I'm eager to see more art. Juliette Binoche, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Juliette Binoche's latest movie, Clouds of Sils Maria, just premiered at the New York Film Festival, and it comes out in theaters early next year. Every October, thousands of haunted houses pop up around the country, ranging from the family in your neighborhood who takes Halloween maybe a little too seriously to big amusement park events. But while the visual production values vary dramatically, they all tend to sound pretty much the same. A grab bag of pipe organs and screams and wah-ha-ha's. That is, until now. A film composer has carved out a niche writing original scores for haunted house attractions. Reporter Ike Shrieskandaraja listens in.
Outside Chris Thomas's apartment, there are no cobwebs, scarecrows, jack-o'-lanterns, or actually any signs that might hint at what he's up to inside.
Most of the time I'm a composer for film or TV, but between the months of June and October, I'm almost exclusively a composer for haunted attractions.
Chris, by all accounts, is the first composer to write original music for haunted attractions. But before it became his job, Chris was just a new guy in town looking for something to do.
I hear they've got some fun haunted houses around here, and I've always wanted to get back into this. And little did I know the scale of what the attractions business offered here in Southern California. I had no clue what I was getting into.
The Los Angeles area turned out to be a very spook-positive place. Before long, Chris had been infected with the Haunter virus.
So every Thursday through Sunday night, I go to maybe two, at best, three haunts a night for the whole month.
One of the biggest in the area is the L.A. Haunted Hayride.
And I attended the show. Thought it was just unbelievable. I loved it. It was one of my favorite attractions in town. I just had one beef with it. They had this minute and 20 second long synthy loop playing over and over and over through the park. And so I thought, we need to do something about this. And they had a hotline that I called. And I said, hey, your attraction was so stunning, but it was undercut instantly by this terrible music. And I get this call a couple weeks later from the owner of the park saying, hey, are you the guy who called and complained about the music?
That was 4 years ago. Chris has composed the music for the Hayride ever since. Each year, the producers change its theme. This season, it's a 30-minute ride through hell on a low flatbed tractor trailer, with Chris's score piped through the whole park. The music acts like an invisible choreographer setting off the scares.
And sometimes I'll arrange these big 2, 3, 4 in the music. When the boom happens, that's everyone's cue to do something, you know, really wild.
Twist
twisted calliope music releases monsters from their cages. Shredding guitars sends demons streaking towards you. And an eerie lullaby lures spooky children who whisper into your ear. One ominous swell of strings raises large human-sized crows on stilts that bend and swoop low, flapping their wings just above your head. What was the scariest part?
Circus? I think it was the circus.
No, the freak show.
The freak show, there we go.
The clowns. They had to cover my eyes.
Everybody looking scared. They come from both sides. Then they sneak up on you and scare you on the music be going.
The music was what making me nervous.
Anytime you get a good original score, it makes it just feel all the more authentic. It brings you into it a lot more when you have a custom score like this. Like you're going through a horror movie experience.
Which is what Chris Thomas is going for. To bring the feel of horror movies into live-action haunted houses.
One of my closest mentors and my composition teacher when I first moved to L.A. was Chris Young, who did, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, Hellraiser, Drag Me to Hell. I mean, he's like the king of Hollywood horrors. And I happened to be assigned to him when I was studying film music at USC. And we ended up being a great match.
Even before Chris got his master's in horror, he seems to have always had a talent for conjuring sounds.
If you give me a mental picture, music just immediately shows up. It's always been that way. So if you paint some picture, I could find some way to spin music out of it.
How does this work exactly? My friend Jordan Kurt, who had come along for the ride, told Chris his own real-life nightmare on Elm Street.
This is a nightmare I had. You're walking down the street at night. You see a paper bag floating down, or, you know, like drifting down the road, and you pick it up and you look in it and there's a head in it.
That can be arranged.
Without missing a beat, Chris leans over his giant keyboard and begins to write a score for my friend's nightmare.
Fix a note.
Layering it.
Messed up.
Building towards a reveal.
Right there, something's going to start going wrong.
Chris digs into his archive of orchestra sounds.
Oh, I forgot I had these.
Until he finds just the right one.
This is obviously where we find the head. Cool. Getting there.
And what would a nightmare be without creepy children's voices?
I love this library. This is the Vienna Boys Choir that was sampled. It's like the real choir, but just one note at a time. It's real kids' voices. Oh, here we go. Something like that. Spooky.
Which is exactly why the haunt industry, and yes, there is such a thing, is taking notice. Last year, requests started rolling in from all over the country for original soundtracks. Chris has written 15 so far. And this year, he taught a composition seminar at the West Coast Haunters Convention in Portland. That's where he met a 14-year-old named Sam.
Sam was like, well, this will be my second or third year running my very own haunted attraction in my parents' driveway. And it's literally a full-time production. I've completely taken over the driveway all year to put this thing on. And I just thought, yes, if you want something, I will compose it just for you, like for no charge.
No trick here. He composed this score pro bono. For Chris, bringing nightmares to life is a treat.
I just absolutely love to be doing this. You know, the moment summer hits, it means it's scary music season for me. So while everyone's out hitting the beach, I haul up in this dark little room here and just set out writing scary music for 3 months. And that's the best.
For Studio 360, I'm Ike Sreeskandarajan.
If you want to go hear Chris Thomas's work in situ at a haunted house, we've got a list of them at our website, studio360.org. And speaking of our website, while you're there, please enter our latest extra credit challenge. We're calling it the Great Doodle Dare. The graphic artist Allison Bechtel has started a drawing for you to complete any way you see fit, any style, any story, anything you can dream up and get down on paper. Your deadline is November 10th, and Allison Bechtel will be back on the show to pick the winner.
Simplest thing, nothing much to it, don't have to sing. You doodle-doo-doo it, so I go along, singing my song. I doodle-doo-doo-doo-doo.
Coming up now, my conversation with composer and artist and Devo co-founder Mark Mothersbaugh. He could barely see until he was 8 when he got his first pair of glasses.
All of a sudden, it was like this veil had been lifted off of the mystery of life, and I saw the sun for the first time. I'd never seen it before.
And as soon as he could see, he wanted to make art. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
It's a beautiful world.
Stay with us.
It's a beautiful world. It's a beautiful world.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Before there was really anything called performance art, Mark Mothersbaugh and his pals got on stage in the 1970s in Akron, Ohio, dressed like space-age janitors with bizarre red plastic hats and played music designed to annoy people. The band was Devo, and almost in spite of itself, Devo ended up with hit records. A performance on Saturday Night Live, stardom. But by the 1980s, one of the founders, Mark Mothersbaugh, had started a quiet sideline, scoring for TV shows and movies. From Pee-wee's Playhouse to Rugrats, a bunch of Wes Anderson's films, and this year's Lego movie. But Mark Mothersbaugh has yet another other major sideline, visual art. His favorite format is the very small drawing, the size of a postcard.
If it's 3 a.m. and I didn't do any drawings all day, I have to wake up and do it.
When we met, he was carrying a whole stack of these postcards.
Like this one, you can see the date.
It was today.
Yeah, it was 4 a.m.
Let me see it. The background of this one is a wash of green watercolor, and on top, a mid-century-ish drawing of a man with a giant industrial gear on his ear. Is that a collage? You didn't draw that gear, right?
It was an image I had found, and I stretched it. So it's a little bit Photoshop, and then finishing it in India ink.
These aren't just some napkin jottings. Mothersbaugh puts real time into the postcards, which makes it all the more amazing that he's produced 2 or 3 of them every day for the last 40 years. For the first time, all 30,000 of his handmade postcards are going to be shown together at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver. They're part of a big Mothersbaugh retrospective called Myopia. It also includes his sculptures, his daguerreotypes, his rugs, and God knows what else. Art that he has shown bit by bit for the last 10 years or so in hundreds of little gallery shows.
I did a lot of stuff in like pop-up galleries and street art galleries with these guys. The MO was like, we just got out of college. We're going to go do graphics for Walmart next year. But before that, we're going to show everybody in Saginaw, Michigan, that some of the best damn graffiti artists in the world are right here. And so they start these galleries that they're out in some warehouse somewhere, and they have 30 people show up, and there's one bottle of wine, and they skate around this guy's art. And
They discovered that you would say yes when they asked you to show up in Saginaw?
Yeah, I started calling these people up, and it was like symbiotic. I got to hang out with people that were still excited about art the way Devo was in the early 70s. And,
uh-huh.
And when I'd call them, these guys, they'd go, oh, you're the guy that writes music for Rugrats. You know, that's they wouldn't even know about
yes,
Devo.
Right.
And then they
But their editors at the Bugle would say, oh, the Devo guy.
No, they would go, oh, the guy that writes music for Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they're usually the guys that knew Devo were probably already retired,
uh-huh.
had heart attacks.
I don't know about that. And some of these you turn into rugs? Is that just because that's a monetizable thing?
You know what it had to do with? I was doing these shows with paper that was hanging on the wall. And I had made a rug for my recording studio on Sunset Strip. And it had the logo I designed for my company. And I walked across it every day. And I one day I just said, I wonder if they could do other things besides logos. And it was this company in Kentucky. And they're like, okay, well, we do football rugs and football season. Don't call us in. We're really busy. But we do baseball rugs and baseball season. And yeah, we can do anything. You can put it on a file. So we went back and forth a few times. And then I got these rugs that felt so nice. It was so nicer than a piece of paper that I'd have to frame and put plastic over it and watch
That makes me want to go there and make rugs out of stuff that I do.
Oh,
can I
really,
do that?
Yeah, why not?
This exhibit in Denver and the book of your work are called Myopia. And as you say, you have myopia. You really couldn't see almost until you got glasses in second grade?
Well, yeah, I'm legally blind without my glasses. And at that time in my life, it was very confusing because when a teacher would say, you know, to me, read those numbers on the board, and I'd go, what's a board? And then the kids would laugh and she'd go, all right. And yeah. Then I'd be in the corner again, or I'd be down at the office and I'd be like, what did I do? I don't get – how do kids know the right answers? And mm-hmm. So glasses, when they showed up, I was almost 8 years old, and all of a sudden it was like this veil had been lifted off of the mystery of life, and I saw the sun for the first time. I'd never seen it before, and I saw clouds. I'd seen pictures and – books, but I didn't really connect that with anything in the real world. And so I just started drawing.
So you grew up in Ohio, went to college in Ohio. You were studying art making when you and your art buddy, Jerry Casale, start Devo. This is a bit of Jaco Homo from your first album. That was Jaco Homo by Devo. That song, which I hadn't heard for a while and remember it fondly, Whip It was your huge hit, which apparently was not at all your favorite song.
Only because I felt like we'd done things that were much more interesting. But, you know, the reality was we had come to believe subversion was the only way to affect change in this country anyhow after we were at Kent State for the shootings, and we saw that rebellion was easy to put down.
And so Whip It ends up being a good thing because it was this surprising hit and got co-opted by the mainstream?
Well, you know, we were looking around, and it looked like Madison Avenue was extremely effective at changing the way people think and influencing their thoughts. And it made them do horrible things, but the techniques – worked. And we thought, well, what if you use those techniques for a different purpose?
So what was the shift that motivated you, allowed you to become this big deal Hollywood music composer?
You know, I got to say, Paul Rubin had something to do with that because he hired me to score Pee-wee's Playhouse. And they sent me a tape on
mid-80s, I guess.
Mid-80s, like 84. And they sent me a tape on Monday, Tuesday. I wrote all the music for a show. Wednesday, I recorded it. And Saturday, we watched it on TV. And I was like, I just went through six albums with Devo where I got to write 12 songs. It took 3 months to do that and then record them. And then I get to write 12 songs every week doing this. And so I was totally excited about it and I became obsessed with it.
Another obviously important person you ran into when he was just starting out was Wes Anderson. You've now scored several of his films, including Rushmore.
Max, care to try it?
I'm sorry, did someone say my name?
In this clip we're hearing, a prep school student named Max steps up to the blackboard in his classroom and works on a very difficult math problem. In fact, you call this piece of music hardest geometry problem in the world.
You got it.
Wow.
That was from Rushmore, and one can hear how you really established the sort of signature sound of Wes Anderson movies.
You know, I love working with him. And those were really great days because he was a new voice and he had a whole new take on our culture that I found very interesting. And he also was very hands-on everything. And you don't always get that. You know, a lot of times when you're working on a film, by the time they get to the music at the end of the movie, the director has just had it, you know.
Right. And you would never be, in most movies, on a set.
Right. They have no use for the composer there. But by that movie, I was already writing music based on the script so that he could have things to listen to in his headphone while he was shooting. So,
really? That's interesting. Another thing you do that if, you know, we could go back in time and say, is the guy who does this, has this art band in 1978 going to be doing this? You make a jillion commercials for everybody, for Toyota and Comcast and Hershey's and...
How did that happen, right?
Well, how did that happen? And is it just like, oh, that's a good day job and that keeps me, you know, pays the rent and, or is it fun?
It's kind of a little bit of all of that stuff. But what originally attracted me to it is this idea of being subversive and using subversion as a way to get into, the belly of the beast, you know, and into middle America and to get them to listen to your music and your ideas. And, the first 30 commercials I did, I put a subliminal message in every one of them.
Literally?
And it was so easy, I lost interest after a while. But what?
Give me an example.
Like Mountain Dew, I put sugar is bad for you. I put in different commercials.
You mean if you play it really slowly, you hear that, or what?
Listen to my commercials for a drum fill, because that's where I can put in sugar is bad for you. And, you know, mixed in
you
with
You actually
something.
Have a vocal track saying that.
The first couple ones I did, I was like so nervous that I was going to get in trouble for it. And I remember being at I want to say it's Daly and Associates, and we're listening to a Hawaiian Punch commercial, and there's a guy tapping his pen on the table, and it gets to question authority. And I remember I blushed bright red, and I look over at this guy, and he's like going, yeah, Hawaiian Punch gets you where you want to go.
Hawaiian Punch, it lets you get all the right places.
It's like people heard what they wanted to hear. Nobody... And it was too easy.
The exhibition catalog starts with a letter from Wes Anderson, your friend and collaborator, saying that he was to build a Mother's Baw theme park in Akron. I've always thought there should be a cool theme park. Is this just a cute dream, or might something like that ever happen?
Well, it only takes one crazy billionaire for something like that to happen.
And there are more and more of those all the time.
Yes.
Well, good luck on that.
Yeah.
Mark Mothersbaugh's retrospective opens later this month at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver. You can see some of his postcard diaries and other works on our website, studio360.org.
Let's run till there's no way to go on. Oh, come on.
A few years ago, Mark Mothersbaugh and his Devo bandmate, Jerry Casale, came on the show to talk about the early days of Devo in Ohio and how the Kent State shootings changed their lives.
Hi, my name's Mark Mothersbaugh. I remember walking across campus one day and somebody had handed me a flyer that said that at noon, SDS was going to napalm a dog. They had this table and they had a dog that looked scared out of its mind standing there. And they said, how many of you are going to let us go ahead and do this demonstration? And And people were saying, none of us. And they said, well, why don't you stop them? Our country from napalming people in Vietnam. And I was just the right age. You know, I was like a sophomore in college. And I said, I'm signing up.
I'm Jerry Casale from Devo. We were protesting the expansion of the war into Cambodia from Vietnam without an act of Congress. So people were outraged.
I mean, we'd seen military vehicles all around the campus, but that they would actually turn and shoot protesters, it seemed, I just couldn't imagine how it got that out of control.
We start our protest. These guys come out of several buildings, gas masks, M1 rifles. They've got about 2,000 students surrounded. And the next thing we know, guys on the top of the hill by the journalism building stop. The first row kneels, the second row stands, and they point all those M1 rifles at us, and they shoot. And to be right there and see the effects of that kind of bullet in a human being, I thought I was going to puke. Then I thought I was going to pass out, and I just sat down on the grass, and I couldn't move. And pretty soon you start hearing wailing and crying, and everybody had been reduced to little children.
What happened immediately is that they closed down our school. Jerry and I started talking about music. And things came into focus for us on what we wanted to do. We saw that right about that time when people we thought should have gotten enraged and be proactive, it seemed like everybody went to sleep. When school started up again in the fall, it seemed like everything was different.
The way a hippie reacted to the killings at Kent State is like, wow, not cool, man. And the killings just snapped me. I had to create, like reinvent who I thought I was. I wanted a complete break with any kind of just groovy, student, hippie kind of appearance or lifestyle.
You know, we thought that the things that we'd seen would have justified a whole new generation of Bob Dylans and, you know, Woody Guthrie's, and it wasn't happening. Instead, we were getting disco and concert rock, you know, the Foreigner and Styx, and nobody was really talking about the issues in the arts. We thought, well, this is a time for us to do something, to say something, and that's how we began.
De-evolution was just the word we slapped on the phenomena that we saw around us. We didn't see the world getting better. We didn't see progress being made. We didn't see people getting smarter. We saw quite the opposite. They tell us that we lost our tails. We were doing it to reach something pure, to get rid of all the assumptions, all the stupid cliches and artifacts of imitating, you know, stadium rock bands or pop bands. Just the opposite. We were going for a purity, industrial brutality. Our feelings aesthetically were a result of the anger and frustration, you know, and shock of the life we were living after Kent State.
Akron, which was a big industrial town from like 1900 through 1960, all of a sudden the factories moved out pretty much all at once. So it was like a really dark time.
You know, what we were doing was keeping ourselves sane, really, and doing something aggressive. I mean, the more the kind of idiot people that were our peers didn't like what we were doing, the more heartened we became and the more confident we became we were doing something right.
Yeah, we absorbed it and went right back at them.
It was like, look, either you're one of those people that let all this happen and even halfway agree with it, or you're with us.
That was Jerry Casale and Mark Mothersbaugh of the band Devo. An album of Devo's demos and unreleased tracks came out earlier this year. And that is it right now for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week. And in the meantime, don't forget to enter your drawing in our extra credit challenge, which will be judged by the cartoonist Alison Bechtel. All the details you need are at our website, studio360.org/doodle. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramasvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Panamaneni,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azoulay,
Amira Nader,
Scott Ross.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
The singer-songwriter who goes by the name Zola Jesus got a reputation for gloomy rock. So why does her new record make me so happy?
I just thought it would be interesting to try to communicate the same paranoia, the same nihilism, with something that just felt more productive.
Zola Jesus, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.